Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and researcher Caitlin McGuirk. She serves as the curator of comics and cartoon art at the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum in Columbus, Ohio. And she's also associate professor at The Ohio State University. And we're talking about her new book, Tell Me a Story Where the Bad Girl Wins, The Life and Art of Barbara Shermond. Caitlin, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
I want to say for the benefit of the audience, this is one of those books I sometimes call, and it's a weird word to use, sumptuous. There's a lot of Sherman's work in this, and that really makes the text. And he did an amazing job of trying to pull all the threads together of her life. How did you first come across the work of Barbara Shermond?
Right. Well, it's been a journey. I mean, I feel like I can say it's my life's work at this point. But I found her work in the archives of the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum, where I'm a librarian here out in Columbus, Ohio. And I had taken my job out here about 13 years ago, was looking through the archive, familiarizing myself with the collection, opened a box, and saw these beautiful, giant pieces on large illustration board by an artist just signed Shermond, whose work and name I did not recognize at all. And looking at them, I thought they had to be from like the 60s or 70s because the jokes were so contemporary, very, very feminist, very kind of queer, and just way edgier than anything I would have expected to be as old as they are. Hopped online and found almost no information about her, and just enough to discover that she was indeed a woman cartoonist and had been working at the New Yorker from the year that they were founded in 1925. And I'm just a person who loves an underdog story, and so the fact that there was very little out there about her was the hook for me to just find out as much as I could over the course of the next 13 years, leading to finally the printing of this book.
I think the amazing thing, among all that, first of all, that's amazing. But you even got to get her ashes, like, repositioned or repurposed.
Right, yeah.
Then what a story! I mean, I can't believe it.
I know.
Most authors are not going that far.
No. I mean, you know, I think everyone maybe who writes biographies, you know, gets to feel close to their subject.
Yeah.
It's another level. Like, most of them are not involved in laying their subject to rest. But it just was a really personal project for me. And I think that, you know, from that first moment of encountering her work, listen, I'm not like a religious person at all, but I just felt like very guided throughout this entire thing. Like, I felt such a deep connection with this artist. And in part, it's because her work, you know, she makes fun of having children. She makes fun of domesticity and marriage and, you know, all these things that we think of more contemporary issues that women are you know, talking about more and more today. You know, she was kind of like the original child-free cat lady. And I think that I found some great comfort in knowing that someone like Shermond had the same feelings that I've had and was living the kind of life that she wanted to live so long ago. And I just kind of fell in love with this artist and have been so dedicated to doing whatever I could to, you know, bring her work back in front of people and get her name out there. The fact that I'm now hearing people talk about her and saying, oh, yeah, Barbara Shermond, she's my favorite cartoonist, and knowing that that's because this work is now out here is an absolute delight. And laying her to rest, you know, once we found out that her ashes hadn't been claimed and dealt with, it just felt like a duty. You know, it was necessary to do that for her.
I'll tell you, having the word getting out recently, just before I called you, and I'm not kidding you, just minutes before, I was looking at my phone, and on my one of my Facebook pages, all of a sudden, one of the cartoons of hers for Done for Esquire came up.
Wow! Really?
I know, and it was Hogan's Alley website, and I was going like, wow, I hadn't seen that before. What an amazing coincidence. Now, I just want to talk about her output in summation first. It was amazing. I mean, yeah. She did at least 600 cartoons and 9 color covers for The New Yorker in its beginning decades. Right. She had her own newspaper cartoons, Shrim and Sally's. She was a mainstay at Esquire. She worked on advertising. She worked on, what I love that she did for The New Yorker and other magazines, these little sort of spot illustrations that would go at the end or the beginning of a piece. Right. They sort of remind me of the tail ends that were done by Thomas Buick back in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
And those are amazing. By the way, I love the fact that you put a lot of those in the inside and backside covers.
Right.
But she was just amazing. Her output was incredible. And the fact that she was ignored in many histories, almost all histories, of The New Yorker was incredible. And when people right. did mention her, they misspelled her name.
I know. It's painful. It really is.
It
painful.
Really
when
is.
When I was recounting all of this and just taking it deeply personally for whatever reason, I think just because she's my girl, you know, but what really blows me away is those spot illustrations. I mean, her
love
cartoons
those.
Obviously are
yeah.
what, you know, her voice comes across most strongly in, but I think kind of marginalia drawings and spot illustrations are the kind of thing that doesn't really get a lot of attention in when looking at art history and design history, because mm-hmm. if you think, you know, these illustrations were accompanying, you know, each department heading, as they'd call it, for the different sections in the magazine. And then they were strewn throughout the magazine, you know, to fill in layout space on a page. But they would be repeated week after week, month after month, for years. And so I, as part of my research for this book, literally went by hand through every single issue of The New Yorker.
I love it.
From, you know, from the first issue until I knew her last cartoon appeared in the late 40s. But I wanted to do that not just because I'm nuts, but also because I wanted to be able to say, look, this is a hard fact. Here's how many times she appeared in the magazine. It's over, you know, thousands because of these spot illustrations, cartoons, covers, advertisements, all of it. And when you look at that as a whole, especially for those earliest and most important years in formalizing the magazine, like her style is baked into the DNA.
Yeah,
it really,
absolutely.
The aesthetic tone for the entire magazine. And you can't, you know, I can't oversell that. It's really her work is essential, and it's important that she's remembered and credited for what she did.
I also want to mention she was the first woman granted membership of the National Cartoonist Society, and that's a big deal.
Right. Yeah,
but
she and her colleagues Hilda Terry and Edwina Dumm were in the first round of the first three women to be inducted. And, you know, comics have always been a really male-dominated art form.
Oh, yeah.
However, women have been part of it since the start. There's just been a tremendous amount of gatekeeping, especially from organizations like the National Cartoonist Society. And it had been founded in the 40s, in the early 40s, and, you know, exclusively for men. It was really an old boys' club. And she and her colleagues, you know, fought their way in and were accepted by 1950. And today, currently, there is a woman president of the National Cartoonist Society. And that lineage, you know, can be traced directly to Barbara, Hilda, and Edwina.
Let's talk about her lifestyle. You mentioned it before. For her time period, it was a really untraditional lifestyle. I mean, she got married twice briefly, but basically she did what she wanted. And traveled extensively, and always it was what she wanted to do when she wanted to do it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, her marriage is it's really, you know, Barbara's not here to tell me exactly what was going on, nor are any living relatives. She didn't leave behind diaries. There's almost no photos of her. You know, putting this book together was difficult, and I made a point to not make any hard and fast claims, you know, definitively about what was going on, because I just don't think that's right. However, looking at it, the two marriages appear to be marriages of convenience in
yeah.
some way or another,
yeah.
because
yeah.
we need to remember that it wasn't until, you know, late 60s that women could even buy property without being married. And so, you know, the second marriage lines up very closely with her buying a house that she lived in alone on the Jersey Shore, the beach house. And, you know, the first marriage lines up very closely with her taking her first trip abroad to Europe, where she lived on and off for years. So, I, you know, there are ways in which I've made some guesses that she may have been bisexual, at the very least. But she lived entirely according to, you know, her own standards and her own whims. And even when that meant that she, you know, couldn't get the work that she wanted to get, yeah. but it was, you know, she was able to travel extensively. She was considered the most well-traveled New Yorker contributor at the time. Lived on her own. She didn't even have a permanent address until the late 40s because she was constantly submitting work from different, you know, ski lodges and beach resorts in Spain and, you know, staying at people's apartments in the city. She just, was really living a radical lifestyle for the time, even for today, you know, and that I think is so inspiring.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and researcher Caitlin McGuirk. She serves as curator of comics and cartoon art at the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum in Columbus, Ohio, and associate professor at The Ohio State University. And we're talking about her new book, which has one of the best titles of any book I've read in a while. Tell Me a Story Where the Bad Girl Wins, The Life and Art of Barbara Sherman. Caitlin, what's amazing is her very early life in San Francisco, where she was born, she lived through the San Francisco earthquake and then lost her mother to the incredible Spanish flu.
It was
like a disastrous early life.
It really was. And I really think that that has a big, I think that plays a big role in why she became this really headstrong, independent person. You know, on a personal level, one of the reasons I think so much of her personal life resonated with me is I lost my mother at a really young age, too. Huh. And I can speak from personal experience that sometimes going through something like that at such a young age, you know, kind of, I don't know, endows you with this sense of mortality that results in you living as fully as possible, you know, in the way that you want with the time that you have when you're aware of how little time you might have. And in, you know, having gone through tragedies like the earthquake in which I'm fairly certain her family lost their home in 1906, and then, you know, a dozen years later or less, having lost her mother and being an only child, having to support her dad after that, it was like, it was rocket fuel for her. And it resulted in her living this really incredible lifestyle in the face of so much tragedy and just being totally true to herself. And I find that, really remarkable.
I want to talk a little bit about her art style. Her early stuff, like I'm talking about the illustrations for City of Caprice by Neil Compton. Mm-hmm. It's really an interesting style. And then it's really interesting how it evolved into what she was working on at The New Yorker. She did she was a very realistic artist. And she did these wonderful little sort of city pieces of her illustrations of that book. But when she moved to New York, her art style really developed a very unique style. How would you describe her art style?
As it evolved,
New Yorker and at Esquire.
Right. I mean, her New Yorker work, you know, in the 20s and 30s is by far my favorite. And I get the sense that it was her favorite, too, because it's what she came back to again and again throughout her career. It's all black and white work done in ink wash. And it's got this feel of looseness in a way that makes it seem like it was dashed off.
Yeah, exactly.
They're flowing. They almost feel like they're drawn like fashion plates, you know. Huh. But of course, with so much more emotion than that. But just that kind of sketchiness to them. And what's fascinating to me, having you know, tracked down as much of her artwork as possible, is seeing that despite how dashed off these could look, she would do them, you know, upwards of two dozen times for a single cartoon. And right. As she said, she would do it just to work the looseness, to work any stiffness out of her hand as she drew the piece and finally get it to hit this spot where it just looked really, really flowing and organic and masterful. They're just, she's a master of body language too. And you really have to be, I think, to be a good panel cartoonist.
A lot of the women are fairly languorous.
Oh, yeah, they're very languorous.
And always dishing dirt with another fellow woman about whether they should get married because there's nothing else to do.
Exactly, right. But poking fun at men.
Oh, all the time.
You know, lamenting settling down and having kids, or just talking about drinking, or talking about each other, whatever. And
talk about the men in her comics, though, because younger men can often seem like, and you write about this, and can seem like they could have been some gay icons at the time.
Yep. Yeah. So one of the things that was most exciting for me to research in this was the overwhelming number of cartoons she did for The New Yorker with nods to queer audiences.
Yeah,
I spent a lot of time in The New Yorker archives, which are held at the main branch of the New York Public Library. And in there, there's a letter written from Harold Roth, the founder and editor of The New Yorker, to one of Barbara's colleagues, another cartoonist, Gardner Rhea, in 1928, saying that he wants to encourage cartoonists to contribute cartoons that would appeal to queer readers.
Right.
So that letter is in 1928. So clearly they knew that they had queer readers, probably investors and staff members and stuff. But Barbara is doing cartoons like that starting in in 1926 for The New Yorker again and again. So many of her men, the younger men, most if they don't seem like they're potentially gay, then the others, the straight ones, just seem totally doddering and
right. They don't.
Yeah.
They don't seem to know how to deal with women or talk with them or anything.
No, not at all.
They know they're supposed to be, but they don't really know what they're doing.
Exactly.
Now the older men, are sort of like out of the Monopoly board. They're all these like barrel chested, large bellied, rich sleazoids.
Exactly.
And the women know exactly how to deal with them.
They do, yeah. And she makes a lot of nods to, older men pursuing younger women.
Yep,
and it was also interesting to me to find out that had a lot of personal resonance in her life because, as we touched on, her mom passed away in the 1918 influenza pandemic, and Barbara moves to New York City, and she's sending money back home and supporting her dad. In the mid-30s, her dad gets remarried and marries someone that's over 30 years younger than him, making Barbara's new stepmother 8 years younger than she is. And you see more and more cartoons at this time in her work come out with these jokes about older men and younger women. So, not that that's a trope she invented or anything. Of course, that's always been around, but it's fascinating to see the personal resonance it must have had.
Well, I'm also fascinated by the older women that she had in her work, too, because they were sort of interesting. A lot of times they were trying to figure out what was going on with the younger generation and trying to catch up with it.
Totally.
But they were definitely matronly, and they're the women who obviously should have been married to those other guys.
Yeah.
But weren't.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of sympathy for those women.
There is. And I think that she to me, like part of the recipe of a really good single panel cartoon is working in contrast.
Yep.
And she leans into that really well, and she plays with generational contrasts a lot, and beauty standards and those kind of changes, but always in a loving way, in my opinion.
Yep.
And that's one of the other things that I think I thought was really surprising about her work is that like her women are almost never in competition with each other.
Nope.
They're always, kind of co-conspirators, if anything, and confidants. And it's just not the story we usually see or hear told about how women, interacted with each other, especially at that time period. So it's really beautiful. And it's clear to me how much she loved drawing women too, let alone women's fashion. She draws fashion so remarkably well. And it's really cool to see how that changes and adapts over the many, many decades that she was working and reflecting the culture of the time.
There's some interesting sections in your book where there are the sketches that she'd be out at a fight or out at a race or something. And she did all these sketches of people while she was there.
Right. Yeah. The New Yorker was really so radical in their approach to publishing and content. Roth wanted, so he had served in World War I and was one of the founding editors of Stars and Stripes magazine. And when he got back from the war, his feeling about the magazine he wanted to start was that he wanted to establish a magazine that would report on New York City the way Stars and Stripes reported on the war. So it was supposed to be kind of, you know, by and for this metropolitan audience, but with a national reach, because they knew people with these, you know, metropolitan sensibilities could live anywhere in the country. And for that reason, he really encouraged his contributors, especially the cartoonists, to get out into the city and sketch what they saw and what was going on, and really capture what felt like real life in New York. So Barbara was regularly sketching from cafes. A number of her sketchbooks have survived, and you can even see her jotting down like little bits and pieces of eavesdropped conversations. that are directly feeding into her ideas for cartoons. So she was really out in the world, soaking everything up and reflecting it back.
Now, her work for Esquire, and I love that you included so much of that in this book too, so that you compare. I found the tone very different for her work.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
It's more sexually explicit.
For sure.
And as I think your description of her women was delightfully ditzy, consumed by dating and diamonds, extraordinarily fashionable. But she still made them her own.
She did, yeah. And so, you know, again, it's really interesting to see the way her work can be so flexible and adaptable to the needs of the publication that she was serving. And also to the changing times that she was, you know, living through. So, you know, the 1920s and 1930s, when she's at the New Yorker, especially the 20s, really radically different things going on culturally than what was happening when she was at Esquire in the 40s and 50s. And her work reflects that. You know, one of the most essential reasons that her work changes so much for that magazine is that Esquire was a men's magazine.
Right.
It wasn't at all what the New Yorker was. And so her work was supposed to be sexy, and it was supposed to be titillating and showing things that the male readership would want to see. So her women change a lot, as does the tone of her work. But like I was saying earlier, with her, you know, need to get a paycheck and live in order to live the life she wanted to live privately, like that was just part of the deal. And she still managed to do it in a way that that does really reflect her personality. So the women may be, you know, scantily clad, but they're also like getting what they want and often using men like again throughout.
And during World War II, military starts to figure in, obviously. Among her characters too, and I love those pieces because they are really wild, and and I want to mention, because we're going to run out of time, she did so much other work. Like, she did the poster work for Du Barry Was a Lady, the film, the Hollywood film with Red Skelton and Lucille Ball, was that it?
Yeah,
and she did advertisements and stuff like that. So she was very. She had a wide appeal to her work, and she really worked to what people wanted. It was just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, she did over a dozen advertisements for Pepsi-Cola during World War II, and I can't imagine how lucrative that must have been. But, you know, comics and cartoon art is male-dominated enough. The world of advertising, and for her to be a woman with a presence in that, blows my mind and is really inspiring. And for the Du Barry Was a Lady film, Varga and Howard Bayer, Esquire cartoonists, were all sent to the set in Hollywood and were sketching throughout the entire filming of the movie. So, you know, she was on that level of recognition that she would be invited in for opportunities like that. And there was a ton of press coverage of their time out there. Really just such a remarkable career.
We only have a few minutes left, but I just want to pay attention to the last portion of her life where essentially she retired to Seabright, New Jersey, where she really found where she wanted to live for a while.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a sad era because nobody really was that interested in her work, although she still did it and she still did art every single day. But she just lived out the rest of her life like that until she had to be put into a extended care facility. But she always was. She was known among the people there as this sort of interesting older woman who was an artist, and that's how she ended her life. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I mean, like we said from the start, you know, like she lived life according to her own rules, and I don't think that, you know, the way that you die necessarily defines the way that you lived by any stretch, you know, and She did. She was fairly estranged from her family at that point. She outlived most of her close friends, and she didn't have kids, but she was beloved by her community and really cared for by her community. And I was utterly delighted when I, you know, going through tons of newspapers in order to research this book, found this really fabulous article in a local newspaper out there from the 70s about how, you know, this local artist had left some money in her will for the local fire department and police department to throw a party for themselves. Like the and she was very explicit in her will that it was for them to, like, paint the town red and go crazy because they'd been so good to her with checking in on her and taking care of her in her later years.
And she left nothing to her husbands.
No.
Now, again, just a minute left, but is her artwork on exhibition at the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum?
So we always have one of her pieces on display in our treasures gallery, but there is a touring exhibit of her work going around. It just closed at the Brandywine Museum in Chatsworth, Pennsylvania this weekend, and we'll be announcing some other venues soon.
Fantastic. My guest tonight has been writer and researcher Caitlin McGuirk. She serves as curator of comics and cartoon art, I'm very jealous, at the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum in Columbus, Ohio. And she's also associate professor at The Ohio State University, but we've been talking about her new book, Tell Me a Story Where the Bad Girl Wins, The Life and Art of Barbara Sherman. Caitlin, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.